Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Don't Miss a Beat. We have our first repeat guest, Dr. Brendan Nguyen, who is a dear friend. He is a nephrologist and clinical trialist at Royal North Shore Hospital and the George Institute in Sydney, Australia. He has been all over the world in the last week, and we're excited for him to join us. Very recently from the ERA Congress, where the exciting flow results were released. And so, Brendan, I want to start off. Nephrology has had almost transformational change in the last several years. Before, we were used to sort of slow progress, tweaks to dialysis schedules, perhaps new medical therapies for select populations. But in recent years, we've seen really marked change to how we manage patients with kidney disease. And so what is your reflection? What was the general atmosphere in Stockholm at ERA?
Thanks, Muthu. And really excited to be here with you guys again. If you go back, the atmosphere at ERA in Stockholm was incredible. So much excitement about a new therapeutic progress in kidney disease, all the way from glomerular diseases to chronic kidney disease more generally, and even transplantation as well. So really exciting progress being made in the care of patients with kidney disease across the spectrum of kidney function. And it's incredible when you think about this in a historical perspective. You go back 10 years or so ago, and there was a lot of therapeutic nihilism around kidney disease. We had a lot of negative trials, a lot of things that we know didn't work, but are not a lot of evidence for new therapies that actually improved outcomes. And even as little time ago as a couple of years, we were still presenting observational data in late-breaking clinical trial session in nephrology. But that has completely changed in the last 5 years. And it's amazing to see the progress now. And I think we're really walking into what is going to be a golden age of clinical trials in kidney disease. And hopefully this is just the beginning.
Quite
exciting. That's great. It's great to hear, Brendan. And I mean, maybe you're turning into a little bit of a cardiology type style with the meetings here and everything with the Simultaneous publication. Obviously, we won't complain about that.
Yeah, that's right. We're learning from you guys. And it really creates a great buzz around the meeting. And you know, it gives an opportunity for people who aren't at the meeting to be part of it and access the latest science in a timely way. So that was a really important feature of the meeting too.
Excellent. So FLOW was really a fascinating trial for many reasons, but has created ripples in even the public consciousness for some time now. I recall even late last year with the initial press release, I saw changes in the stock market, and we've never seen that with any therapy, with any trial. And so tell us about the anticipation leading up to FLOW before even the main presentation publication.
So Muthu, there was always going to be a lot of excitement about the trial because it is at this time the only completed GLP-1 receptor agonist primary kidney outcome trial. It's a therapy that has increasingly large benefits and broad indications across the cardio-kidney metabolic spectrum. So there was always going to be a lot of interest in the trial. And then, as you know, last year, the DSMB stopped the trial early based on clear evidence of efficacy at a pre-specified interim analysis. And that just heightened the anticipation further. And as you alluded to, with the trial being stopped early, there was even a press release from DaVita, one of the dialysis companies, responding to the trial being closed out early and the potential impact on instant dialysis patients in the United States and elsewhere. And I think that, along with all the media coverage that has accompanied the trial, New York Times, CNN, and other outlets, really speaks to the way in which the drug has entered the public consciousness in a way that even SGLT2 inhibitors and other drugs that are clearly efficacious in this population haven't. And I think that is a really unique dimension of the trial and the medication. and potentially also has implications for an impact on implementation of the results, because this is not something that not only doctors or nephrologists know about. This is something that patients know about too and are asking about.
No, I mean, I totally agree. In my own clinical practice, it's one of the few drugs that patients have actually come to me and brought up the topic of a specific medication instead of the other way around. So they truly are activated to be seeking this medicine for a variety of different reasons. But now, you know, we talked earlier about the buzz at the ERA meeting, and obviously flow was, you know, top of mind and underlying a lot of that buzz. And we talked about the public perception, the stock market. So now, you know, in terms of our listeners may or may not have read the New England Journal paper that is now accessible and published. You know, I'll give a brief summary, and then Brendan, I really want to get your thoughts as really an expert in this, you know, kidney outcome space. So it's approximately 3,500 patients, all had diabetic kidney disease. They all had an eGFR of 25 to 75, a UACR of about 100 to 5,000 in range. They were followed for a primary endpoint of progression to end-stage kidney disease, 50% reduction in eGFR, renal death or cardiovascular death. As you know, Mutu and you alluded to, the trial was stopped early for overwhelming efficacy and a 24% relative risk reduction in the primary kidney endpoint. But then it really hit all the key confirmatory secondary endpoints, including MACE, the eGFR slope, and including a 20% reduction in all-cause death, you know, the endpoint of all endpoints. So, you know, with these results, Brendan, I mean, obviously it's a slam dunk. It seems like an absolute blockbuster, but what is top of mind for you as you kind of like internalize these top line results there?
Yeah, Steve, I think that's a great summary. You know, if you look at all of the components of the primary outcome, semaglutide seemed to favorably affect all of the components with directionally similar benefits, but also a very clear reduction in cardiovascular death, almost 30% reduction in cardiovascular death, which is amongst the clearest signals for that component of any of the key therapies we have for slowing kidney disease progression, SGLT2 inhibitors, non-steroidal MRAs, et cetera. So that is a really important finding of the trial. And it's important because the major dominant competing risk in this population is cardiovascular death. So most patients will die most commonly due to cardiovascular causes before reaching kidney failure. So a key part of the therapeutic strategy in these patients is reducing cardiovascular outcomes. And here you see a very clear effect on cardiovascular. I think that's the first point. Mortality is very all-cause mortality. I think that is such an important outcome for obvious reasons, clear evidence there. And also, the slope data, really interesting from a mechanistic point of view. We know that these drugs reduce body weight. Some of that reduction in body weight might be due to loss of muscle mass. So there have always been concerns that GFR slope estimates or treatment effects on GFR slope with incretin-based therapies might be falsely affected or biased by the reduction in muscle mass, which affects serum creatinine-based eGFR. But we see, based on GFR serum creatinine and also GFR cystatin C, virtually identical treatment effects on change in GFR over a two-year period, which are really reassuring from a nephrology point of view, that what we're seeing is a true effect on preservation of kidney function. And as you mentioned, there was a hierarchical testing strategy, and every single confirmatory secondary endpoint was positive. So this was as clear as it gets in terms of efficacy, and lots to talk about in terms of adverse effects as well, because there is interesting data there too.
Excellent. So let's dive into some of these aspects really quickly. So Brendan, you are on this podcast as a repeat guest for a very specific reason, because there's very few people in the world that can answer some of these questions. And so we want to get your take on the mortality data. So mortality, of course, is a compelling endpoint. But we haven't seen many trials really across cardio-kidney metabolism meet an endpoint like all-cause mortality or even cardiovascular mortality. And that's for a very specific reason, because there's a lot of complexity in these trials. Patients experience a diverse range of external factors that beyond the trial intervention. And so it's difficult for an individual drug or individual intervention to truly affect that ultimate endpoint of mortality. So this reminds me sort of EMBER-EG outcome, where we saw a very large reduction in cardiovascular mortality and all-cause mortality. And that was the first in class medicine to really demonstrate cardiovascular benefits with the SGLT2 inhibitors. And now we're seeing this as the first in class for GLP-1 receptor agonists to reduce mortality in kidney disease, and perhaps even across CKM. And so do you anticipate that these mortality signals are going to become attenuated, let's say, with subsequent trials? Perhaps we're going to have some regression to the truth, and maybe we're seeing this kind of outsized effect as the initial trial in this space?
I think those are really good points, Muthu, and it's difficult to know with any certainty. We're kind of forecasting what might happen in future trials in some respects. But I do think that that effect is probably real. You know, there is a clear benefit on cardiovascular death. And I think the important thing to recognize with FLOW is the follow-up is longer than the other previous outcome trials of an SGLT2 inhibitor. So the median follow-up in FLOW was 3.4 years, Credence was 2.6, and EMPA-KIDNEY was 2 years. And Credence, all of those trials were stopped early, and perhaps we might talk about that later on. But, you know, Credence, if it had an effect on cardiovascular death that was just didn't reach statistical significance, I think p-value was 0.052. And so I think trial duration does have an impact on our ability to detect treatment effects on an outcome like cardiovascular mortality, and FLOW benefited from that longer follow-up. We may see that with future trials of incretin-based therapies or with semaglutide, that magnitude of benefit may be less prominent. But I think it's probably real and consistent with all of the data we have for semaglutide and GLP-1s more generally. And the point about mortality is an important one, because if you look at the event rates for death in the placebo arm in FLOW, this was higher than EMBER-EG outcome. It was higher than Credence. And so this is a really, really high risk population in terms of overall mortality.
Now, terrific points. One thing you briefly mentioned, Brendan, was that there was a little bit more weight loss as expected with semaglutide versus placebo. But a couple points I want you to highlight with this. So we're used to thinking about these therapies as weight loss, and some of the recent trials like SELECT, for example, actually had, you know, BMI cutoffs to get into the trial. And they also went for the very high dose of semaglutide titrated at 2.4. You know, here we had no BMI cutoff, and we actually had a cap at the 1.0 milligram dose. So I don't know, put all this together for us here in terms of, you know, the dosing, the BMI, the weight loss, and, you know, any relation to the results we saw in FLOW.
Yeah, this is really interesting and an important point. You know, this was not a weight loss trial. This was a CKD progression trial. There was no BMI entry criteria. In fact, a substantial proportion of the participants had a BMI less than 25, and will be interesting to evaluate the consistency of treatment effects across the range of BMI studied in the trial, which I'm sure we'll see. And also, this was not, as you mentioned, the weight loss dose. This was the diabetes dose, 1 milligram semaglutide subcutaneous once weekly. And also, this was not a glycemic-based trial either. Although patients had to have diabetes to get into the trial, there was no lower limit of HbA1c to be enrolled in the trial. And many patients had an A1c less than 7.5, a substantial number, which is pretty much a target for this population anyway. So this is a population that is well-controlled from a glucose perspective, yet you're seeing these clear benefits. And when you look at the magnitude of the effect on intermediate outcomes like body weight and A1C, 4 kilograms for body weight, 0.8% for A1C, these are relatively modest in the setting of the treatment effects that we're observing, and I don't think fully explain the treatment effect by any degree. And in fact, probably the minority of this effect is being driven by improvements in body weight and glycemia. Certainly, that is what mediation analyses suggest from previous studies of semaglutide. But I think overall, there are likely to be direct effects of the drug on kidney protection or kidney on the kidney that are distinct and separate to the effects on weight loss and glycemia.
So I'm going to push you on that aspect here. So we just talked about doses in the lower range. At ERA, the SELECT kidney outcomes data were also presented. And SELECT tested the dose of 2.4 milligrams once weekly subcutaneous injections in a population that was much lower risk, of course, but did demonstrate some degree of kidney protection, especially in slowing progression of albuminuria. So you have a patient that you're treating with type 2 diabetes, chronic kidney disease. They have achieved some weight loss, some modest glycemic control with 1 milligram. Do you push them to 2.4 milligrams? Is this something that you anticipate would garner greater kidney protection, perhaps other cardiovascular benefits?
Yeah, it's a good clinical question, Rita, that I think will come up increasingly. We, as nephrologists, have always been quite risk averse and generally conservative with respect to adverse effects, primarily because adverse effects in general are more common in patients with reduced kidney function, especially those with advanced CKD, irrespective of the therapy being used. And so, you know, when we have evidence for kidney protection or preventing progression of kidney disease and cardiovascular events with the 1 milligram dose, I think most people will be comfortable sticking with that dose rather than pushing it up to a 2.4 milligram dose, unless there is a compelling reason to address severe obesity, like grade 3 obesity, or trying to avert the need for bariatric surgery, or in some cases, which is relevant to us, you know, managing weight in preparation for kidney transplantation, which is always can always be challenging. So those are probably the situations in which physicians might opt for using a higher dose, where the dominant clinical priority is getting patients' weight down, particularly in preparation for kidney transplantation.
So let's now shift a little bit in our gears to think about implementation, Brendan, because, you know, we already talked about how, you know, I've had plenty of patients be what I call activated and come actually seeking this medicine. So that's a unique aspect with implementation. But all the other aspect is now we have multiple therapies, and you've really been on the leading edge now talking about these pillars of, you know, CKD and with diabetes therapies. And, you know, as a heart failure cardiologist, you know, we've been used to the pillars now for some time in that terminology. And, you know, myself and others, we've argued even from a simultaneous rapid sequence upfront early combination therapy, talking about heart failure as really being a what I would call a universally high or extreme risk patient population. Then also our therapies also seem to work pretty quickly with early separation event curves. How do you, you know, think about combination therapy from the nephrology perspective when you have now all these tools in your toolkit?
Yeah, I think there is a lot to learn from you guys in the heart failure space, in particular about using multiple therapies. I think there are lots of different questions that we need to address along the way, and recognizing that we are at a much more nascent stage of the conversation and implementation phase than you are in heart failure cardiology. So I think the first thing that we need to recognize as a community is the need for multiple medicines. If you look, because, you know, we are just getting, most nephrologists getting comfortable using SGLT2 inhibitors, without doubt, one of the biggest practice-changing developments in nephrology in the last 20 years, period. But, you know, when you look at the rates of GFR decline, even in patients receiving an SGLT2 inhibitor, high-risk individuals like those with high levels of albuminuria are still losing 3 to 5 mL/min per year, which highlights the need for additional therapies. And if you look at the strongest predictor of progression to kidney failure, even on an SGLT2 inhibitor, it's your residual level of albuminuria. So we are starting to think about the concept of residual albuminuria much in the same way that you think about LDL cholesterol and, you know, residual risk from an atherosclerotic perspective. And then that means that, you know, to answer the question of do we need combination therapy, of course we're going to need it for many high-risk individuals. The question is, who should we be implementing it in? How do we do it, and in what sequence? And those are the unanswered questions in many ways. And you mentioned in heart failure, that conversation or that implementation of four pillars of GDMT in heart failure is all predicated on the concept that everyone is at high risk, universally high risk, which is true. You look at the event rates for heart failure, hospitalization, and death in patients with HFrEF, and it is astronomically high. Now, when you look at CKD, there is a much greater degree of heterogeneity, although I don't want to underplay the risk that patients face at the same time. So, you know, a 90-year-old person with type 2 diabetes and no albuminuria has a very different risk profile and competing risk of non-renal, non-cardiovascular mortality compared to a 50-year-old person with nephrotic range proteinuria and type 2 diabetes, very different to a 46-year-old woman with IgA nephropathy and 1.5 grams a day of proteinuria. And so I think, especially given the cost of some of these therapies, implementation based on underlying absolute risk and the an approach which prioritizes absolute risk reductions is probably the most feasible and implementable in terms of practice. And if you look at the KDIGO guidelines, there's now a 1A recommendation for using a risk score, validated risk score, to estimate a patient's absolute risk of kidney failure. So we can use the KDIGO heat map or a risk score, identify patients at highest risk, and then in those individuals, prioritize accelerated upfront combination therapy, especially in patients with normal kidney function and high levels of albuminuria, because those are the individuals who are going to gain the greatest long-term benefit from preservation of kidney function. And also the early return on investment in those cases is actually prevention of cardiovascular events, especially heart failure. So those are the kinds of individuals I think we need to prioritize for combination therapy and like a rapid sequence approach, if you will. And it also highlights the need for additional randomized evidence testing different implementation strategies, just as you've done in heart failure with strong HF. And doing that in the setting of CKD, I think, is going to be really critical for building the evidence base for combination therapy.
Excellent. So Steve and I are simple cardiologists sitting on the sidelines here, playing nephrologist on a podcast. And we're wondering, many of the recent trials in nephrology appear to be in people with concomitant type 2 diabetes and chronic kidney disease. How do you manage in 2024 the large population of patients without diabetes but progressive kidney disease who are at high risk? And do you see similarly designed trials with GLP-1 receptor agonist or other incretin-based therapies in people without diabetes?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, because on aggregate, non-diabetic kidney disease accounts for most of the burden of CKD worldwide. Of course, the single most common cause is diabetes, but the majority of patients have non-diabetic kidney disease. And I think that much in the way that we've now had pillars of care for diabetic kidney disease, we're going to have a similar approach in non-diabetic kidney disease as well. Now, we already have RAS inhibition SGLT2 inhibitors. There is a trial that we spoke about previously called FIND-CKD, which is evaluating the effect of finerenone in 1,600 patients with non-diabetic kidney disease. If that trial is positive, then it will finish in 2026. That will hopefully establish finerenone as another treatment for non-diabetic kidney disease. And then what we haven't spoken about so much is all of these therapies in non-diabetic kidney disease focus on targeting maladaptive responses to injury. So they're not disease specific. Now, there is an important role for actually targeting the underlying pathogenesis of the non-diabetic kidney disease. So let's take, for example, IgA nephropathy, which is an immune-related condition related to the generation of aberrantly glycosylated IgA, immune complex formation and deposition in the kidney. So therapies targeting the production of aberrantly glycosylated IgA or reducing glomerulus inflammation through inhibiting the complement pathway are also going to be important if we're going to actually target the underlying mechanism of injury. So I think in non-diabetic kidney disease, it's almost like a two-pronged approach where we have disease-specific therapies, but also the disease-agnostic therapies that target maladaptive responses to injury. And there are many ongoing trials, for example, of endothelin receptor antagonists in combination with SGLT2 inhibitors in diabetic and non-diabetic kidney disease. So I think we're going to see a similar pillared approach in non-diabetic kidney disease evolving over time too, which share many of the components of DKD.
Yeah, I mean, it's super interesting. I mean, we already highlighted the select secondary analysis, you know, a non-diabetic patient population seem to have renal protective effects, mostly driven by prevention of macroalbuminuria. You know, and the other thing too, is there's so much overlap in all the different CKM conditions. So whether you have obesity, ASCVD, diabetes, CKD, you know, odds are a patient might have an indication for a GLP-1 receptor agonist, an SGLT2 inhibitor for maybe a variety of different indications. So, but with that being said, Brendan, I just truly want to thank you for being our first repeat guest on Don't Miss a Beat. I mean, you did such a fantastic job. I think we're eventually destined for a three-peat here. So we'll look forward to having you back in the future. But with that being said, I just really want to thank everyone for listening to this month's episode of Don't Miss a Beat. You can check us out on hcplive.com and where you get all of your podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and online. So with that, thank you, Brendan, for the terrific commentary, and we'll see everyone next time.